The 2007 to 2008 financial crisis hit people at the bottom hard, but all the growth during the so-called recovery seems to have been enjoyed at the top. That top-heavy economic growth was only exacerbated by the tax reform last year, which amounted to a staggering upward redistribution of wealth. Wealth transfers are hard to see on a day-to-day basis, but one place that our currently skewed system seems increasingly visible, with impossible-to-deny evidence right before our eyes, is in housing or the lack of it. Increasing numbers of homeless people, even though we have some 6,000 to 7,000 vacant properties at any one time in this city. This juxtaposition of houses without people and people without houses puts us all in a morally awkward position, being confronted by a homeless person asking for help, and it feels like on one shoulder we have the Good Samaritan telling us to help them out, while on the other shoulder we have the economist telling us we're just making the problem worse by making the practice lucrative. Meanwhile, although we might be glad that Metro Council late last year authorized $500,000 for emergency aid for homeless people, that doesn't address what you and I should do as individuals. Moreover, it doesn't change the dynamics that create homelessness in the first place. So what's going on? What should we do if we're serious about not just trying to make homeless people go away, but trying to help them get into stable housing and help people avoid homelessness in the first place? These are difficult moral questions, questions about how to live our lives on a daily basis as individuals, and questions about how to help build and strengthen institutions that cause genuine good without unintended negative consequences and perverse incentives. Well, as Alex Forward on WFMP 106.5 FM in lovely downtown Louisville, Kentucky, my name is Avery Kohlers, I teach philosophy at U of L, and every week on this show I sit down with a scholar, an activist, or a practitioner to discuss ethical issues in our daily lives and social institutions. This week, my guest is Amy Scheer, Executive Director of LHOME, the Louisville Housing Opportunities and Microenterprise Community Development Loan Fund. I'll be talking to Amy about what LHOME does and how she sees its role in confronting the dynamics that cause homelessness and other social ills. Full disclosure, I've supported LHOME financially. It should be a great discussion. It's Ethics Forward, and I'm talking to Amy Scheer, Executive Director of LHOME, the Louisville Housing Opportunities and Microenterprise Community Development Loan Fund. Amy, welcome to Ethics Forward.
Thanks for having me, Avery.
So can you start us off by introducing yourself? What got you working in this area? What's the source of your passion for this work?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up here in Louisville, actually, in an apartment raised by a single mom. You know, I'm Jewish, and we grew up in an apartment complex, and we actually had a barbed wired fence outside of the windows. We were facing north in our apartment, and we faced a wealthy neighborhood, Hayfield in the Highlands. So I was looking through a barbed wired fence at backyards of people with swimming pools and big houses. Wow. And I did not grow up in a house, and I had a single mom raising three kids. And so I think from a really early age, and my mom was a social worker at, she was at the Jewish Community Center. She directed the senior adult department for 31 years. And so I think from an early age, I questioned class differences. I physically felt that barbed wire fence. Were they keeping us out of that neighborhood? Were they protecting themselves? You know, these questions emerged as a kid, yeah. Right? And so I've always been interested in class differences and finances and single parent issues and religion and my faith tradition, you know, with Judaism, the concept of tikkun olam and sort of the repair of the world, mm-hmm. that has been a concept that just lives with me every day. How can I contribute to the betterment of the world? Not because I'm going to go to heaven or avoid damnation, but just because it's the right, just thing to do. So it really informs the way that I live. And I think my upbringing really led to a passion to, I went to a liberal arts college up east, and then I went to the New York City government, and the disabled community in New York City sued the state because they did not have affordable, accessible public transportation, and right. they won. And I was on a team that built a brand new paratransit transportation system for the disabled community in New York City. And what I learned in that experience was, how do you provide optimal service with very limited resources?
Right.
And then, you know, I got a master's in public administration and concentrated in state and local finance because I didn't know anything about finance. But I knew that you needed to know about finance because, you know, again, how do you deliver service without money, right? Or scarce resources? So that is sort of the emergence of sort of how I got into this work. And I won't go through my resume, but I will say that in the year 2000, leading up to 2000 with the new millennium, I had been in banking and investment banking, and I rated municipal bonds on Wall Street and learned a lot, but it wasn't really feeding my soul. It didn't really matter. You know, my work didn't mean that much to me. And so I approached Jewish Family and Vocational Service was led by a woman I had babysat for as a kid. And it's such a Louisville story. And I went to her and I had this very strong, robust financial background. And I said, I would like for the new millennium to do work, use my financial background and do good in the world. And they had just gotten a grant from the federal government to explore how to introduce refugees, newly resettled refugees in Louisville, to the American banking system and to teach them financial education and to help them with credit. And then we matched their savings up to $8 for every dollar saved for one of three assets, a home purchase, a small business capitalization, or a college education. And so I got to take this grant that they got that they didn't know what to do with the grant. And I was hired to launch the program, this refugee savings program. And then I got to work with refugees, and I'm in a nonprofit setting, and I am seeing people really put in the time to learn, to save, and then to acquire assets, right? And it was a transformative experience for me. This is about 20 years ago. And so my whole arc of my career since then has been around economic empowerment and economic justice. And how do you provide tools to people that haven't traditionally had access to those tools for whatever reason, to promote ownership, to promote asset building, so that we level the playing field more?
Right.
And so that's really where my passion comes from. And there's a lot of opportunity to do this kind of work, even in our own town.
Right. Wow. That's amazing. So, okay, so that was the big transition in 2000. And now ElHom, maybe say something about how ElHom realizes or aims to realize this aspiration.
Absolutely. So, interestingly, two springs ago, so I'm consulting the whole country and Native American tribes and Puerto Rico on asset building initiatives, and Congress zeroed out the grant funding of the work that I was doing. And so I went out, and this is another Louisville story. I get on social media on Facebook and I say, hey guys, Congress just eliminated this amazing grant program to promote asset building for low-income people. I would like to do this kind of work in Louisville. And so ElHom is a nonprofit that was started by Judy Teal at Jewish Family and Career Services and Kathy Hinko at the Metropolitan Housing Coalition. And it was started about 6 years ago because what ElHom is a CDFI, a Community Development Financial Institution. There are about 1,000 of these nationwide. And what they did, the two of them talked about the fact that Louisville was really underserved by these kinds of financial institutions. And the primary goal of a CDFI is to provide financing to communities that historically have not had access to good quality financing. So they started this nonprofit up, and when I put out on Facebook that I was about to lose my job, the board had just been reconstituted because Jewish Family and Career Services and the Metropolitan Housing Coalition knew that housing was a big component of this work. And that was, they were neither lenders primarily, nor were they housers primarily. So the board now, it started with New Directions Housing Corporation and the Housing Partnership. And those are the two largest providers of affordable housing in Louisville. And then Adam Hall, who's with Fifth Third Bank, he came over from Metropolitan Housing Coalition, and that was the board composition, newly organized in January of 2017. And then they hired me company in about June of 17, a year ago. So LHOME, it's primarily a lending institution. We are a community development loan fund. And so what we exist to do, we are mission driven and we are a not-for-profit organization. And our primary mission is to help residents of low-income communities access capital to achieve their dreams of ownership. And so that could be small business ownership. It could be home ownership. It could be helping people who own homes but lack capital to repair their homes, to afford capital to repair their homes. It could be for elderly homeowners who are struggling to pay property tax bills to, again, pay those bills and stay in their homes and work with us to find sustainable ways to continue to stay in their homes and pass those homes on to their beneficiaries when they pass along. Right. Because, frankly, our CDFI, at least 60% of our loan products have to go to low-income census tracts in Jefferson County and Louisville. And so if you look at the map that most of our lending is done in, it mostly comprises census tracts in West Louisville. And then there are census tracts, low-income census tracts in South Louisville, where our office is here, right off Taylor Boulevard and Berry Boulevard, very close to Shively and the start of West Louisville. And there are census tracts east of I-65 as well, like Newburgh, and there are some low-income census tracts in Buchel. But our primary responsibility is to provide at least 60% of our loans to individuals in those low-income census tracts. Now, the other thing that we have to do is primarily we have to lend. So while we are providing these loan products, we are also providing financial coaching. We do a lot of work with a small business, for example, to help them look at their budget and look at their business plan and look at their marketing plan and really help them get to the next level, to stair step their growth. So the financing is really critical if you need to purchase more inventory to have more sales or hire another staff or get the refrigerator unit or right. the vehicle or whatever it is that you need to stair step both the financing of purchasing and acquiring assets, but also to be able to hire more staff to build your capacity to build your business. Similarly, the loan products around housing are greatly intended. You know, there's a major racial wealth gap in this country, and home ownership has been the primary way that Americans have built wealth. And there are a lot of historical reasons why our communities of color, for example, have not had access to home ownership the way that right. white people have. You know, redlining. Literal redlining, a line was drawn around, and if you're in Louisville, a line was drawn around West Louisville. And even if you were middle class or upper class or whatever your class was and whatever your credit capability was, there was a line drawn around the neighborhood that basically said you're unfit for investment from banks and you're risky. And what that practice did was meant that people of color were denied access to loans that would enable them to buy or repair homes in their neighborhood. Right. Well, if the primary way to build wealth in this country is home ownership and you can't access capital, I mean, for the listeners, I don't know many of us that have bought a home without a mortgage, right? And so when you look for the mortgage, you look for a good mortgage and low interest rate and good terms, favorable terms. And so if you lack access to that mortgage, you lack access to ownership of a home. And right. that is the primary way that people build wealth in this country. And it's the primary way that people pass on wealth to their beneficiaries.
Right.
So what we're really focused on is helping existing homeowners, particularly in low-income neighborhoods, repair their homes, stay in their homes, have plans so that they can pass on the equity of that home value to their beneficiaries, but also to stimulate the market and help people who've never been able to own a home to be able to own a right. home. But in addition to that, a thriving neighborhood requires that you have small businesses in there also. You have some place to go eat and you right. have a place to go shop and you have food, healthy food, whatever it is. And so a CDFI is really there to help stimulate the entire neighborhood, not for the purpose of other people to come in and reap the benefits of gentrification, but to work with the residents of the neighborhoods and give them the tools that they need to achieve their dreams of ownership.
Right. Okay, so that was extremely rich, and I want to sort of pull on a few specific things that you referred to. Maybe the first is lending, and you said El Home is not for profit, and it's engaged principally in lending, and I've heard you elsewhere draw a sharp line between what El Home does and sort of predatory or payday loans. Can you explain what's the difference between the one and the other? Why is the one good and the other bad?
Right. Yeah. So look at a payday loan, for example. The entire business model is actually based on a model in which you create a debt trap for the client. So the client comes to a payday lender with an emergency. Typically, it's a $200 to a $250 need. My car broke down. My child is sick. A short-term, small-dollar loan is needed to get me back to work, to get me back so that my car is running so my kids can go to childcare and I can go to work. And what happens at a payday lender is they make very short-term loans for two-week periods of time. They take your checking account information, and they charge, in Kentucky, the interest rates on these loans can be up to about 400% interest. And this is legal.
Right.
It's immoral. Right. It should not be legal. And in fact, the Department of Defense got all payday loans that are targeting military families to cap them at 36% interest, right, because it was for national security. If you provide a predatory loan to military personnel and they get in this debt trap and then they're paying back $1,000 or $2,000 on a $200 loan, it starts to really tear the family apart and make things difficult for them. So we do not have legislation currently in the Commonwealth of Kentucky that caps these interest rates. Now, the reason why predatory lenders have been so successful, these payday lenders, is that what you've seen because of redlining and because of the risk profiles and safety and soundness and all of the things that traditional financial institutions look at, there is a banker for every 200 people in the East End, and there is a banker for every 1,600 people in the West End. So you don't have access to bank branches.
Right.
And so if you need transportation, you have transportation issues, you know, whereas in the East End, you could, if you were a walker, you could walk to a bank branch. In West Louisville, that you don't have bank branches. And what happens is the check cashers and the payday lenders, because they're not regulated the way that a traditional financial institution is, they're going to go to where the need is. And there's a need for short-term financing, right, to fix my tire. So what El Home and other CDFIs attempt to do is be present in the community and provide the residents with alternatives to payday loans so that they don't get into a debt trap and they don't get into a problem that leads to bankruptcies and foreclosures and things like that.
Right.
But a CDFI, a nonprofit, it's a small organization. We lack capacity. We're not on every street corner.
Right.
So we really need to collaborate with other nonprofits and churches and faith-based organizations and community area ministries to get the word out about our products so that we can try to make a dent in the every corner check casher and payday lender that really is, you know, in the community.
Right. Is that something that it would make any sense to aspire to, is to have El Home branches or on every corner, as it were? Or is it just a different beast and the issue is not to have branches, but to just have people know they can access that or something?
Well, I don't know that branching, I mean, if you think about the business model around branching and sort of the capital that's needed to be in a branch, but to have us be co-housed within churches and to have us be in LCCC, you know, for example, and community centers and neighborhood places, and then to train other staff that are seeing clients for a myriad of other things to know how to make a referral to El Home, and then to go to those locations where the people live, where the people work, and to do the paperwork for lending and to do our coaching there. That is a great model, and that's a sustainable model.
Right. Yeah.
And then the community's all involved with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I see. Yeah, that's right. Okay. So a number of other issues have come up, and I want to make sure I don't drop them all. Maybe one to ask specifically about is the role of the federal government here, and government in general has had an important role in causing the very problems that now federal money is in part being used to help alleviate. So I guess, so one question, are there trust issues for you and are there trust issues for your clients? And how do you negotiate the sort of multifacedness, not even two-facedness, of the government in an area like this?
Yeah, so clearly the government has had very systemic, institutional, racist policies that have harmed the community. You know, you look at redlining, you look at white flight and some of the causes for that, for the, you know, the GI Bill as an example.
Right.
The program guaranteed low-cost mortgage loans for returning World War II soldiers, but discrimination limited the extent to which black veterans were able to purchase homes in the growing suburbs.
Right.
In fact, the FHA largely required that suburban developers agree not to sell houses to black people in order for the developers to access these guaranteed loans. These are government programs.
Right.
Urban renewal, also government program. So, you know, you had highway system expansion and mass clearance of homes, businesses, and neighborhood institutions like the thriving, what was the thriving Walnut Street corridor.
Right.
And then the foreclosure crisis, you know, these were the, you know, the subprime lending resulted in mass foreclosure. So I think trust issues are absolutely there and legitimate. So the way that we build trust is we are a community development financial institution. Community is the first word in what we are. And so it is imperative that our board have accountability to the community. We have an advisory committee where members of the community get together at least monthly, and they actually bubble up the products that we innovate and that we create and we deliver. So all of the products that we're doing bubble up from community members to say, hey, there's a problem. We have a vacant and abandoned property problem. And we have a problem where elderly low-income homeowners no longer have escrows for their property taxes. And we are seeing foreclosures, you know, for $200 to $500 of unpaid property tax bills because these property tax bills get sold to third parties.
Right.
After April 15th, over the summertime, and you can, there are people with a strategy anywhere else in the country to foreclose on these homes and flip the homes, and they can acquire them with a $500, you know, tax lien.
Right.
Right. So all of the products that we have bubble up from the community. So that's a trust builder, is that the community bubbles up the products. The community then tells about us to their ministers. I and other folks on the advisory committee and the board have been asked to come to church services and talk to congregations. So the pastors are critical at building trust. In fact, we just had a celebration of becoming certified by the CDFI fund. That kind of stamp of approval, that seal of approval, is sort of like FDIC insurance is for a bank. You know that it's been vetted and that this isn't a place that's going to make a predatory loan and you're going to have regulations and be watched and stuff. But the trust really comes from being embedded in the community. I will say that, you know, as a white woman with privilege, it is critical that we hire staff that are African American, that are part of the community of color. We are working very closely with a lot of our Somali clients to do referrals for us and working out compensation for the communities of color to actually help spread the word about the products and be part of the revenue sharing of this nonprofit. Our board, five of the board members, although they are accountable to the investment area and one lives in Smoketown, a white person that lives in Smoketown, we have two African American women that we've added to the board. So two of the seven are African American in the community and doing this kind of work, small business lending. But trust, you know, you have to listen and understand privilege and have the community state what the needs are. You don't come to them with a solution to the problem.
Right.
You listen, and then as a lender, you know, how can the community let us know what kinds of capital is missing?
Right.
And what kind of capital are folks lacking access to? And then they create the products. And then they're a big part of spreading the word about the products and about L Home. And eventually, and I will say this just to be very clear, although I have this weird skill set that combines understanding of financing and, you know, I have a banking background and investment banking background with this heart of mine and this passion of mine around economic justice, I've made it very clear in the community that if there are African Americans that we, you know, want to have this role as executive director of El Home, that I will work with people and we will see how that can happen. Because I'm not at all interested in philanthropic redlining. I'm not at all interested in being yet another white-led nonprofit doing this important work.
Right. Can you just clarify what you mean by philanthropic redlining?
It's a topic that's come up, and there's actually a conversation that's being hosted around this. I think Daryl Unseld at the Metro United Way is spearheading the work. But philanthropic redlining is around philanthropies supporting primarily white-led nonprofits.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Right.
So, and I think Sadiqua Reynolds would be a really good person to lift this up and say, we need Black-led organizations doing the work for West Louisville.
Right.
And she's absolutely right.
Yeah. That's super interesting. And that came from a question about the role of the federal government. Kind of, you've answered that in a way that started to address another question I had about, or two other questions I had about trust issues, one of them being the role of corporate banks in, maybe you can say something about what the role of corporate banks is and how, and there's, for all the reasons you've already said, there's going to be similar trust issues there with corporate banks as there are with the federal government. So what's the place of commercial banks and how do you, I mean, negotiate those trust issues as well?
Right. It's a very complex situation. There is something called the Community Reinvestment Act. It's about 50 years old, and the Community Reinvestment Act was enacted to ensure that banks loan money and provide investment and service activities to low-income communities and communities of color. So it's 50 years old, and we have a fear now that it's being watered down.
Right.
But in any case, because of the Community Reinvestment Act, financial institutions now have what are called CRA exams periodically. And in a CRA exam, their regulators are going to look at whether they are lending, investing, and serving these communities, communities of color, low-income communities. One of the primary ways that a financial institution can get a very positive check from the regulator, you know, check as in not money, but, you know, yes, you did what you were supposed to do, is to invest in a CDFI, like El Home.
Right.
And so we are actively working with traditional banks to provide loan funds to us and grant funds to us so that we can just redeploy those loans to communities that they primarily still don't serve.
Right.
Now, they don't serve them not because redlining, you know, there's a line drawn around the community, but if you have safety and soundness practices and you can't make a certain kind of loan to someone with less than a 650 credit score, then you're eliminating a whole lot of the population from being able to access those loans. So a CDFI comes in. We do not compete with banks, but we definitely take investments from them. Now, are banks a problem with all this issue? As someone who runs a CDFI, what I will say is I invite every single bank, there are 30 some odd banks in Louisville, to partner with El Home to do the right thing around investment, lending, and service in the community. And if you have bank branches in West Louisville, bless your hearts and go do that and build your branches and provide good products and services. If you want to supplement that activity by investing in El Home so that we can do the kind of lending that you can't do right now. Mm-hmm. And then what we do is we report to the credit bureaus so that we help people build their credit.
Right.
And then we want them to be banked by the BB&Ts and PNCs and Fifth Thirds in the world. We don't want to be the lender for the community long term for the same people.
See.
We want to help build their capacity and credit so that they go to the traditional financial institutions.
Right.
But there's a swath of the population that isn't being served by the commercial banks and is being served by the predatory lenders, and that's the space in which we live. And so we absolutely need the commercial banks and the philanthropic community. And the philanthropic community, just to be very clear, a James Graham Brown Foundation, Community Foundation of Louisville, the Gaines Foundation have all invested in Out Home because they see the problem of disinvestment and these historical, you know, these historical problems, and they see the need for a CDFI. And banks really should step up to be a part of the solution rather than not investing in these communities.
Right.
We make it very easy for them. So, hello, bankers. Give me a call.
I'll be back with Amy Shear on Ethics Forward in just a moment. First, here's Cloud9 by Prismic. I'm talking to Amy Shear, Executive Director of L Home, the Louisville Housing Opportunities and Microenterprise Community Development Loan Fund. This is Ethics Forward on WFMP Louisville. And Amy, I wanted to ask you about microloans as a phenomenon. I first learned about them probably in the 90s when Muhammad Yunus from Bangladesh sort of got famous with the Grameen Bank. And he later won the Nobel Peace Prize. And there was a bit of pushback on the phenomenon of microlending. And I'm going to try to encapsulate this. And I think it came from the left. So I'm in principle sympathetic to it, but I also want to hear your take on the question. And it is this, the kind of structural underdevelopment that has created the problems that microlending is trying to solve is the kind of thing that can't be solved by microlending, both because it's micro and because it's lending. And maybe this goes sort of back to the trust issue with the federal government. There's a sort of a bitter joke about free speech, right? Like, if free speech mattered, they wouldn't let us have it, right? And I almost want to ask if the same thing is true about federal, like, Community Reinvestment Act and federal support for CDFIs. If it was really going to do the trick of eliminating African-American poverty and eliminating the wealth gap, the government wouldn't be funding it. That's more bitter, I think, than I would want to be, but I'm trying to give voice to this concern. And I wonder if you have a response to it. How do you approach that worry about the role of microlending in the enterprise of capitalism more generally, if that's
right.
The right word?
Right. So L Home, we are not solving the big structural imbalance problems. A CDFI is not going to do that.
Right.
We are a nonprofit lender, community development lender, and we have to raise capital then to re-lend it out, and then we need to pay interest, you know, on the capital that we raise, and so we make very thin spreads.
Right.
So I think CDFIs play a role in addressing the racial wealth gap, in promoting ownership, in providing capital to small, medium, and large businesses, et cetera. Our microloan product goes up to $15,000 And it does go to the entrepreneur that may not, that can't access capital. A lot of examples of that might be someone, we have a lot of refugees that want to drive Uber or Lyft on the weekends and they're right. working at the Amazon plant. Right. We get them their car so that they can supplement the income. And yeah. we have clothing, we have, you know, retail facilities, we have a we have grocery stores, and we have Somali refugees that need a larger freezer for their goat meat, et cetera. So these are small loans. Right. They're not going to tackle the whole oppressive system of the racial wealth gap or capitalism for that matter. But they do solve problems for people, but it's not a systemic cure. And CDFIs really struggle to be sustainable and scalable, right? Because right. now, microloans are just part of what we do. Mm-hmm. And a lot of CDFIs, a lot of them just focus on small business. A lot of them just focus on housing-related things. Right now, we are doing both. And we are actually raising capital right now to help affordable housing developers. So we're making larger loans, say $150,000 loans to places like River City Housing, which is a community housing organization right. that gets vacant and abandoned properties and whatnot and builds homes for home ownership. Mm-hmm. So the microloan is not all that we do. It's sort of part of a myriad of products of things that we provide. But I see the need for micro lending, for small business lending, again, to meet that entrepreneur where he or she is, to help them build their operations and wealth, and then to be able to access larger financing right. as their collateral and as their character and as their credit and all that stuff expands. But it is not the panacea to a systemic problem right. that we have. Absolutely right. not. It's a part of a solution, but it's got to be a small part.
Yeah. So there are a lot of dynamics you've mentioned about how people sort of need a little bit of cash for a short term, which drives them towards payday lenders, where people need an infusion of capital in order to be able to get their business off the ground. And you've sort of started to mention a few of the things that you've funded. So maybe you can walk me through from start to finish how a successful loan works, right? So how the person finds you, how you lend and coach and get them towards to where they have fully paid off and maybe are qualifying. Have you had people so far who have moved on to get loans from commercial banks? Can you walk us through this sort of that arc of somebody's experience with LHOME?
Sure. And I'll just pick one product because most of the products, we have about 27 loans out right now, and about 16 of them have been these small business loans up to $15,000. All of those loans have gone to our community of color, by the way. And although we've only really been aggressively lending, you know, I was hired last year. So we had three right. microloans on the books at about $7,000 a year ago. Mm-hmm. And we have 27 loans on the books at about $156,000 on the books now. But we have had a couple of loan clients go ahead and pay us off. We inherited some loan clients from Jewish Family and Career Services because they were operating LHOME before right. this board transfer. So we have had folks pay off their loans successfully and not need us anymore because they're obtaining financing from traditional financial institutions. But the primary way that that this works is, I'll give you an example. I was at the LCCC at a Be Your Own Boss mm-hmm. economic summit. So primarily entrepreneurs of color at the LCCC, and I was invited to talk about the financing, how to finance your business. And so in the group, there were maybe 50 folks in the group, and I talked, and we got a call that day from a gentleman whose parents own a trucking business. Uh-huh. So we were in the community talking to entrepreneurs needing financing in West Louisville. Get a call. My parents have a trucking service, and their truck is in the shop, and they need right. $15,000 to fix the truck.
Right.
And their whole business was at a standstill because they have the one truck, right? So within 3 days, we met with the owners of the business, the couple that owns the business, and we have some paperwork to do. We look at the business plan. We look at their finances and their tax returns, and we look at the credit. and any collateral. But again, we really work at access, right? So we work to streamline the process. All of our applications and checklists for all of our products are on our website now. So within 3 days, we closed on a loan for them to have the $15,000 so that they could fix the truck and be back in business and driving their truck again. So, right. You know, they said no one else would lend them the money. Okay. Uh-huh. No, they have a mortgage on their house. Their whole living, you know, that for this couple, for this family was riding on the truck
right. That
was in the shop that they need capital to fix a truck. So right. That is a very common way that people find out about us. We go into the community. We talk at the Urban League here's another example. So we really want to get minority and women contractors involved in whatever the boom is going to be in West Louisville. So there's the Passport Complex, right? There's Russell Choice neighborhoods. There's a track and field. So we've got a lot of work that could be done, right? And so the developers say we don't have minority participation. And a lot of minority folks say we need our capacity built and we need capital so that we can do the work. So L Home comes in and says, look, if you have a contract with a developer, we will get you working capital so that you can buy your flooring and your tools and stuff to do the work. And we're not looking at credit in that case. We look at the contract that you have. And that streamlines getting them the working capital. We're not looking at the underlying credit. We use the contract. And then it's a shorter term loan. So the way we find out about that is we've been telling the Housing Partnership and New Directions Housing Corporation and Louisville Metro Housing Authority and Jeffersonville Housing Authority about our working capital product. Mm-hmm. So they might have someone that comes to them and gets a $15,000, $20,000 flooring project, and they tell them, L Home can help you with up to $15,000. To be able to do the work that we just signed you on to do the work for. So that's another way but everything relies on the community sort of helping spread the word. We don't have this enormous marketing budget. So we have to be in community and we have to be developing products that the community needs. But as you can see, if you're a minority and you get a contract and you don't have access to a loan, or capital to now deliver on the contract, you're not going to do the work. You're not going to be successful. So we're really hoping to bridge those gaps with these kinds of financial products. And then we get repaid. These working capital products get paid back to us within 90 to 120 days whenever the work is done. So yes, we've had clients who've done the work, paid us back, and may need another working capital loan for the next project that they're working on. We've got a Black Lives Matter loan out right now. They have housing that they're developing. They have a contractor that they're working with in the community, and he needed a working capital loan. We made a $12,000 working capital loan. Black Lives Matter builds housing for the community. This guy is working capital. He's going to pay us back next month. He may come back to us for more housing. So it's really, that's what we're here to do. Just get money to the people. Again, we need to be paid back because we want to make more of these loans to the community. There is some risk, and we need to raise money for what are called loan loss reserves because not everybody's going to be able to pay us back. And so we need to, you know, be aware of that and shore up our finances for that too.
Can you talk about that? A part of what you do is you've described it as coaching, and how do you prevent or prepare for the people who aren't able to be successful with the loans?
So we are a lending institution. So we have a loan review committee. So we have a loan officer, and the loan officer gets all the paperwork that I just talked to you about from the client. And then the loan officer makes a recommendation whether to go forward a loan review or not. If he doesn't or she doesn't make a recommendation to go forward a loan review, we tell the client, these are the kinds of things that you need to do before we could make a loan to you. And we can help them with that, but we're not even ready to make the recommendation loan review. Then we have a loan review committee of people in the community who do this kind of lending at other places, like Metro Louisville, like a bank or whatever, know the community, and they look at all that stuff. they may or may not approve that loan packet, right? Now, if the loan review committee approves the loan packet and then we go back to the client and we close on that loan, there's still risk, right, that the person isn't going to be able to repay the loan. Now, most of the risk that we see right now is with one particular product that we have, and it's the property tax assistance loan.
Right.
So we've made 7 of these loans to primarily elderly folk on very low fixed incomes. And so if you think about it, paying us back a loan to pay the property tax, which they had struggled to pay, is not very surprising that there might be difficult challenges paying us back on the loan, right? So this product, I think, needs, and we've been very transparent about this, what we really need to do as a community is be looking at the fact that we are selling property tax bills to third parties, right? So there's there's an advocacy part of this that we're a part of, right? And that's a state legislature issue. And then just working at not having that happen. And then there's this larger issue of working with homeowners around how do we stay in the home and how do we escrow property taxes and homeowners insurance and stay in the home and keep it fixed up and things like that.
Right.
And I think that's a larger community conversation too that requires input from faith-based organizations and community groups around how to do this kind of coaching to the families.
Right.
I don't think a loan product to pay a property tax bill is solving a big problem. And it started because of the vacant and abandoned property problem. We wanted to avoid these people, you know, losing their homes and then creating more vacant and abandoned properties. But a loan for 1 year's property tax bill and maybe at 1 or 2 delinquent property tax bills does not solve the problem of then how do you pay back the loan? And then how are you going to be in the position to pay your property taxes next year?
Right.
But as a CDFI and as a nonprofit, we get to bubble up. We get to innovate.
Yeah.
We get to try things and then we get to learn from them.
Right.
I think that particular product is flawed, is difficult. And we're looking at how to make it better so that we're really tackling this larger issue of how do we help people stay in their homes and how do we prevent these people being foreclosed on and how do we prevent more vacant and abandoned properties cropping up in the community.
Right.
Did that answer that
question? Yeah, absolutely. We're almost out of time. Quickly, are you not allowed to just give people money?
Well, we are a community development loan fund.
Right.
So the primary purpose of us is loans.
Yeah.
If we get grant funding to provide grants, of course we will provide grants.
Right.
So most of that is just the restrictions of the capital that comes to us. How is that to be used? Now, I will tell you that we plan to go to a foundation to talk about combining grants and loans for this property tax issue.
Yeah.
One of the things we're thinking about is working with community partners and churches, providing a grant to help them have these conversations and do some of the work and then combine some grants and maybe stack a small loan in there to help solve some of the problems around the property taxes.
Right.
But, you know, again, primarily what we have to do is lend. And of course, we're mission-driven lenders. So let me just tell you, in terms of the lending for these property tax loans, we take a mortgage on these loans. We are nowhere close to even, we're not going to foreclose on someone for a $2,500 property tax loan. So why are we taking a mortgage on a $2,500 loan, right? Mm-hmm. So grants to people are a really good idea. And I think in terms of reparations and the bigger issue, wealth transfer and access to capital without strings attached, I think that's got to be part of the solution.
Right.
And if we can be part of that from our funders and as an intermediary to pass along grant funding, maybe we don't even have to be in the picture. Maybe there's another organization like what's happening with Russell Promise. Mm-hmm. You know, if there's wealth transfer happening, transfer the wealth, you know, give it to the people, trust them to do the right things with the money. I'm all for that.
Right.
But the particular seat that I sit in right now as an executive director of a community development loan fund, primarily what we do is lending. Mm. And we are innovating and we are developing loan products that can help people not be upside down in the loan, that can help them be successful at building their credit, paying us back, and infusing capital where it's needed to have these economic benefits for their families and add employees and add stability right. to a neighborhood, et cetera.
Right.
But it certainly is a small piece of a puzzle.
Right.
It's an important piece, and it hasn't been done well in this town, and
yeah.
it's being done better in Indianapolis and in Nashville and in Memphis and in Columbus and in Cincinnati, and that's why we're doing it here.
Right.
And we want to leverage federal resources. We want to use the funds that we're gathering here and have a multiplying effect so that we can get more of this capital out to the community.
Right. Fantastic. Amy Shear, we're just about out of time. Last quick question. Suppose somebody wants to find you because they want to loan, and or somebody wants to find you because they want to support L Home. Where do they do that?
So we have a website. It's lhomeky.org. lhomeky.org is our website. You can donate on the website, and you can learn about us and volunteer with us. You can also apply for a loan on that website. We also are on Facebook, and it's two words to search for our Facebook page, L Home, L-H-O-M-E. The next is C-D-F-I, C D as in David, F as in Frank, I as an institution, L Home C-D-F-I, if you could like us on Facebook. The nice thing about our Facebook posts is that we're constantly lifting up success stories of our loan clients, so you can actually see where your money goes and the kinds of impacts that we're making business by business, homeowner by homeowner, and in neighborhoods. So those would be the best ways to reach us. I can be reached personally at ashir, A-S-H-I-R, at lhomeky.org, and the phone number is on the website and the Facebook page as well. And by the way, everybody, if you are a small business person and you have struggled to get a small business loan, please call us and find us. We may be able to help you with that. And also, property tax bills have been sent out now. And if you're struggling to pay your property tax bill and you're worried about this, please call us, because we do have a product to help you pay that property tax bill and to help you stay in your home for at least another year. So again, these are products that are time sensitive, and we'd really love to help you if you are struggling with those problems. We have products for you. Thanks.
And that's A. Shear
at lhomeky.org. Please email me, and we can get that product information to you to help you pay those property tax bills and help you grow your businesses.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for being on Ethics Forward.
Thanks, Avery. Thanks for doing this for the community.
Oh, thank you for doing this for the community. That was Cloud 9 by Prismic, and before that was my interview with Amy Shear, Executive Director of L Home, the Louisville Housing Opportunities and Microenterprise Community Development Loan Fund. Forward Radio is a volunteer-powered community radio station in lovely downtown Louisville, Kentucky, broadcasting throughout Jefferson County on 106.5 FM. Ethics Forward comes to you every week on Tuesdays at 6 p.m., Wednesdays at 10 a.m., and Thursdays at 8 a.m. If you're outside our broadcast area, you can listen on forwardradio.org or find the entire Ethics Forward SoundCloud archive at forwardradio.org/ethicsforward. This show always benefits from the music of Prismic, who's also on SoundCloud at Prismic Official, and I am grateful to Maddie Claybo for her editorial production and strategic support, and to the U of L Philosophy Department for making her work possible. Ethics Forward will be back next week celebrating Martin Luther King Day. I hope you'll join us. Now, to take you out, here's Sage by Prismic.